for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The U.S. will send troops and missiles to Turkey to help defend it against threats from Syria. In Egypt, tensions run high ahead of a national vote on a draft constitution. North Korea claims a breakthrough in its long-range missile program, and the European Union appoints a new bank watchdog. Joining me for the International Hour, the Friday News Roundup, David Ignatius of The Washington Post, Indira Lakshmanan of Bloomberg News, and David Sanger of The New York Times. I invite you to be part of the program. Give us a call, 800-433-8850. Send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or Twitter. Good morning, everybody. Thanks for being here.
Morning.
Good morning, Diane.
Indira, let me ask you about Defense Secretary Leon Panetta's order to send two Patriot missile batteries to Turkey to defend against any possible Syrian attack. Doesn't this simply escalate our involvement in what's happening in Syria?
Well, I'm not sure that it's an escalation so much as it is part of what we have to do as members of NATO with Turkey as a fellow member of NATO. And remember, this is a decision that was actually taken last week while Hillary Clinton was at the NATO foreign ministers meeting in Brussels. And so we already knew on November 30th that the NATO members, including the U.S. and Germany and Netherlands, had agreed to supply Patriot missile batteries to their ally, Turkey, who was understandably fearful about incursions over the border from Syria. So really the only new announcement from Panetta as he's on his way to Turkey, this announcement came today, was that they're going to be providing these U.S. forces to help with manning the Patriot missile battery.
How serious, David, is the threat to Turkey from Syria?
Well, there's been shelling across the border. Syrians have shelled in the far northeast and at other points, and that's created a lot of anxiety in Turkey, in part because there are Turkish minorities of Alawites and also of Kurds, and there's just an anxiety about internal restlessness. I do think that this is an escalation. You'll have U.S. troops on the ground participating in what is, by another name, a kind of no-fly zone. These Patriots will have some reach over Syria. That yes, they'll protect Turkey, but they'll also, you could argue, protect opposition forces in the north. And the U.S. is moving, some argue late, toward a more committed role in assisting the opposition. I think these Patriots are big, powerful weapons, and that they'll ease some of the criticism that I've heard when I was in Syria from Syrian opposition fighters that the U.S. has done too little to help them.
Now, David Sanger, the U.S. has agreed to recognize the Syrian opposition.
They have agreed to recognize the Syrian opposition. As David says, there's a big question about the degree to which the U.S. has come to all of this somewhat late. The French, the British recognized this opposition group a few weeks before the U.S. did. And, of course, it was the U.S. that was responsible for putting it together.
And now, what difference does it make?
Well, that's the critical question. It's the right question, Diane, because the connection between this group of basically exiles who are part of this opposition group and the actual Syrian fighters on the ground in Syria is pretty tenuous. And at the same time that we recognize them, we also declare that an al-Qaeda affiliate, or at least an al-Qaeda sympathizing group inside Syria, was going on the terrorist list. So what we're trying to do is pick our rebels. We have the rebels we like, and we have the rebels who are more al-Qaeda related. The fact of the matter is we have very little control over any of that. But let's go back to the Patriots for a moment. It does escalate the American involvement, but in a very narrow way. Remember, we put Patriot missiles in South Korea during the Clinton administration, during one of the many nuclear standoffs with North Korea. In recent years, we have put anti-missile batteries, including Patriots, in Israel. We've put them in Arab states that are concerned about attack from Iran. And as Indira said, if a NATO country is subject to some kind of random attacks, you don't have much of a choice but to go do it. But I think that the other sort of subtle message here is that the capability of the Patriot is only a few miles for an incoming Syrian missile. It's significantly bigger, longer, against airplanes, which are a lot slower moving target. So if you're a Syrian pilot and you are suddenly put up along that border where the rebels have sort of had their strongest enclave, you're probably going to think twice now, if you're a Syrian government pilot, about how close you want to get to this Patriot missile battery. And that part of this is just the psychological game of it.
Go ahead, Indira.
Part of the deal in the approval by NATO of these Patriot missile batteries was the clear statement by NATO as well as by Turkey. And Turkey even repeated this statement again today, saying that this is not a no-fly zone. This is not an offensive operation. The aim is only to deter any threats defensively. It's a defensive operation. So that was the aegis under which this was all approved. Now, I don't disagree that this obviously steps up U.S. involvement, but it also steps up German and Dutch involvement. And my point is simply that this is also, keep in mind, this is part of NATO also deploying the airborne warning and control system aircraft, AWACS, in Turkey this month on a training exercise. So there's a lot that they're doing to try to protect Turkey from the dangers from Syria.
And David, how crucial is the admission by Russia that the rebels might win and then the stepping back from that statement from one of the top officials?
It's potentially important if it's a precursor for a Russian a change of position towards helping to broker a political transition. If the Russians mean what they say, that Bashar al-Assad is going to lose, then it follows logically that the Russians are going to want to adjust their positions so they don't go down with the loser and they protect their interests. The Obama administration has been almost begging for this Russian involvement. I think I've said on the show, I certainly have written, that I think U.S. policy ought to be to help Vladimir Putin win the Nobel Peace Prize by brokering a settlement, because the consequences of continued sectarian shaded war in Syria are so disastrous.
But just how supportive is Putin of acknowledging that the rebels might win? What about that backward stepping?
Right now, Diane, Putin, a stubborn man, has not made any public change in his position. This was a deputy foreign minister who made the comment. He did make it in a statement on the Russian news agency, so it carried a kind of official flavor. But I'm sure the administration is looking very, very hard now in private discussions to see how do we move this forward. There's a lot of talk that I hear about deterioration of the Syrian position in Damascus. Top generals, top Alawite generals close to the Assad family in contact with the U.S. and its allies. So there is this sense of the ground giving way under Assad.
This is a critical point, because until now, what we've not seen in Syria is the military crack. And we haven't seen a crack because the top levels of the military, as David says, are all Alawite, and it's an all-or-nothing game for them. If they lose, they think they and their families are dead. There's sort of no place for them to go. So the trick here for the Russians, if they can do it, is negotiate safe passage out for Assad, also for many of his Alawite leaders. Not clear that that's going to happen. They could well decide to go down fighting. And this is why there was such a scare 10 days ago about the chemical weapons. Now, we saw this week, and the Times reported 2 days ago, that the Syrians, for the first time, have launched Scud missiles against the rebels. Imagine what a remarkable thing this is, launching missiles against your own countrymen. You don't see that happen very much. And one of the most remarkable things is the Obama administration has said almost nothing about it, including condemning it, which is seems sort of strange. When if you go back and you think about what happened during the Persian Gulf War, there was, you know, a lot of condemnation when these kinds of missiles got launched. The concern is that the next and most desperate step would be to put chemical onto the warheads of those missiles. That has not happened yet. There have been a lot of warnings to the Syrians about don't move the chemical weapons. The President Obama has said this would be the red line for U.S. intervention, but it's still a risk.
It's always there will be consequences, but nobody ever spells out what those consequences would be.
Yeah, you make a good point. And part of the problem with the Obama administration drawing such a red line about chemical weapons is it suggests that anything up to chemical weapons is okay. Go ahead, fire whatever else, fire the Scuds, as long as it's not chemical weapons. I mean, that's certainly the implication. And I think it also sends a dangerous message to Hezbollah. Remember, they also have their own Scuds. And so if Syria is able to fire off, you know, the estimates are that they have an arsenal of something like 700 Scuds. If they're able to fire those off, it's not only a sign of their own desperation within the regime of using these, which are not very targeted or accurate weapons, but it also, you know, sends a worrisome message if the U.S. is not going to react. But I did want to say one thing about the Russians, which is the Russians today have very strongly pulled back from those remarks from the deputy foreign minister that were reported. And they've even suggested that those remarks were not necessarily meant for reporting. It's an odd one. It's unclear whether maybe he gave something that in his mind was a background briefing to Russian state media and that it got reported anyway. But they've certainly stepped back from that now.
Indira Lakshmanan, she's senior correspondent covering foreign policy for Bloomberg News. Short break. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the International Hour of our Friday News Roundup. And here's a question. What would happen to China's and Russia's influence in the region if the Assad administration collapses? David.
Well, it will decline. I think it'll decline regardless. The Sunni Arab world is furious at Russia and China for sticking with Assad, rightly reasoning that if they had abandoned him, as the rest of the world generally did, that he'd be gone now. So I think the Russians and Chinese are gonna suffer for it diplomatically. If the Russians broker a transition, they'll regain some of that.
All right, Dan, let's turn to the statement by the UN ambassador, Susan Rice, that she wants to take her own name out of consideration as a possible candidate as Secretary of State. I asked the participants in the last hour whether they saw any connection between her doing that and the ongoing negotiation on the fiscal cliff, David?
Well, it's fascinating. You want to hope that the White House played for some benefit from this. What I'm told is different. What White House sources tell me is that this was really Susan Rice's recognition that she would be so bruised and damaged by the confirmation fight that was ahead that it was wise to pull back. Now, was that preceded by a private conversation with the president and the first lady, who are both very strong supporters of Susan? I don't know.
From the people I have spoken to on this, I think she did consult with some White House officials, including Valerie Jarrett, including Ben Rhodes, who's one of the deputy national security advisors and who was on the campaign in 2008 with her. But I have no indication that the White House told her it was time to go. Now, maybe they concluded that the fact that you didn't see roaring support coming up for her, that she would sort of read the tea leaves and come to that conclusion. How is it connected to fiscal cliff? If she had not pulled out, I think it would have been virtually impossible for the president to announce his entire slate of national security appointees, which includes defense, where we're hearing a lot about former Senator Chuck Hagel, the CIA, Secretary of State, of course, before the president returns from his vacation into the new year, because they'd have to get fiscal cliff through first if she was going to be a contentious issue. Since she's withdrawn from this, I think it's very possible you could see that entire slate get announced next week.
Was she the victim of election year politics, or might she have been the wrong choice to begin with, Indira?
Well, I don't think anyone can argue that she wasn't qualified for the job and that she hasn't spent her entire life preparing for this job. So I think that argument is specious. I mean, there are people who didn't like her because she's got a very strong personality. One of the people who I interviewed for a profile of her was Madeleine Albright, who's known her since she was 4 years old because Madeleine Albright was friends with her mother. And Madeleine Albright, having herself been both U.S. ambassador to the U.N. and Secretary of State, sort of ridicules the arguments about her being abrasive or pushy and says, look, you sit behind a sign that says United States at the UN, and your job is to advocate for the US as strongly as you can and not to win a popularity contest. So in a way, that's kind of a silly argument, I would say. On the other question about Benghazi is a really complicated one. And I really liked a column that I saw by Bill Keller last week in the New York Times, in which he talked about the importance of being there and having foreign correspondents on the scene, on the spot when things happen. And he sort of made the connection to the fact that the early reports after the Benghazi attacks, basically every single one of them, without exception, connected the opera, the attack, the fatal attack in Benghazi, to the protests that happened in Cairo and in Tunisia against that video. And he made the point that a lot of, so-called classified intelligence and intelligence reports is often based on news reporting. And when you don't have reporters on the ground, it's hard to know. I mean, intelligence reporting changes over the days. So I'm not entirely sure that we know yet. The Accountability Review Board hasn't come out about Benghazi yet, and it's possible that what she says is true, that those were the top talking points she was given, and that's what they knew at the time.
I found the main line of the Republican attack against Susan Rice about her statements the Sunday following the September 11 attack on the consulate in Benghazi fabricated. I thought it was a made-up scandal. She was essentially reading from talking points that were prepared by the CIA. Bill Keller's piece was excellent, but there actually was intelligence, monitoring of conversations among insurgents from the group that attacked the consulate that showed first that they'd been watching the demonstrations in Cairo and then that they talked about the demonstrations in Cairo and that following that they made the attack. There is no evidence that the attack was pre-planned. The analysts have been looking for that. It is true, and Susan Rice didn't say this, and this is part of the case against her, it is true that some of the attackers were from a group, Ansar al-Sharia, which has links to al-Qaeda, which is a terrorist group, and if they could have said that, they should have said that, but apparently they thought they couldn't.
I thought that Bill's column on this and the importance of being on the ground was not only important, but it reinforced something that I remembered within the Times' own reporting. We did have people on the ground who got to Benghazi very quickly, well ahead of the American investigators, and reported in the first couple of days after that that there had been no protest outside the embassy related to this. And this was before Ambassador Rice went on TV, that we had that in the paper. And so it does make an important point about why it is you need to have independent reporters there. And frequently, as Indira said, intelligence reports do get based on things that are in the news. But I think that there was something else that was going on here as well in the case of Ambassador Rice. She has this very blunt style, which my colleague Jody Cantor and I argued in today's paper is actually what President Obama admires in her most, because she frequently says things he would like to say, but as President of the United States cannot say. And she's very in your face in a way that we're told by President Obama's aides he is when he is in private and in situation room meetings. There was a great example of this on Wednesday, the same day that she was drafting her letter to the president pulling out of contention for Secretary of State. You may remember that the night before, the North Koreans had launched off a rocket. We'll probably discuss this a little bit later on. The Chinese, in an informal meeting of the Security Council the next morning, were trying to be apologetic for their ally, the North Koreans, their troublesome ally, the North Koreans. And the Chinese ambassador said to Ambassador Rice and others who were assembled there, now there was no interruption of, there was no threat to regional security from this. There should be no UN statement against them. And Susan Rice looked at him and said, that's ridiculous. And he looked back at her and said, watch your language. Okay. So this was an example of the sort of sharp elbows approach that to some degree you kind of need at the UN.
At the UN.
Now, the question is, does that work when you're Secretary of State?
Exactly. Yeah. And so now there's an awful lot of talk about John Kerry and whether, in fact, he has some shortcomings that might work against him.
Well, John Kerry is a very familiar face. He ran for president and lost, been in the Senate for almost 30 years. I think the criticism of him is that he would be a conventional choice. There's some evidence that he's not quite as conventional as you might think. He has been an advocate of reaching out to adversaries for diplomatic solutions to problems, most specifically Iran, Hamas, Syria, or before Assad's troubles. And he also is somebody who has been used by this president as an emissary in some delicate situations involving Afghanistan's President Karzai and the government in Pakistan. And by the White House's account, did a good job in these person-to-person contacts. So that would be the case for John Kerry.
But does he have a close personal relationship?
No. He doesn't. It is said that the president found him awfully long-winded when he was the stand-in for Mitt Romney during the debate prep. And, Obama likes kind of crisp, blunt, as David said. It's no surprise he kind of likes Susan Rice. They're going to have to figure out a way to get along, because there was some distance between President Obama and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. And as good as she was as Secretary of State, she could have been better if she'd had a real confidential relationship.
Interesting. Go ahead.
Look, I think one thing that has frustrated the Obama administration in the first term is that they did not have their guys, the White House's guys, in some of the key national security positions. So Secretary Clinton obviously had been the president's rival. It was an incredibly canny, smart political move to make her Secretary of State, but in no way could you say that she was originally part of Obama's inner circle. And even though I think she was a very good soldier and has been very loyal to him in carrying out his policy, again, she's not part of his inner circle, and neither was Gates. and so at DOD. So I think there was a very strong feeling in the White House that the president wanted Susan Rice so he could have his guy, his woman, there at the State Department. Now, if he gets Kerry, that's not his guy. And I'm not trying to suggest that Kerry would be in any way disloyal to the president or would not carry out his foreign policy. But he could be overshadowed by someone closer to the president as national security advisor. And let's not, you know, Susan Rice isn't going anywhere. And it's entirely possible that she may eventually become national security advisor and have that kind of relationship where she overshadows the Secretary of State in the same way that you could say Henry Kissinger did when he was national security advisor, or Zbigniew Brzezinski did when he was national security advisor, and overshadowing a Secretary of State.
We should not forget that before she became close to the president, Susan Rice had previously supported Hillary Clinton and then jumped ship.
Well, she hadn't declared for Hillary Clinton by any means. She had worked in the Clinton administration, in Bill Clinton's administration,
right,
as Assistant Secretary of State, handled Africa. That was something people were beginning to go back and look at her time there when her candidacy was still live. But almost as soon as Barack Obama arrived in the U.S. Senate, Susan Rice was there talking to him, tutoring him. And she went over and sided with him very early. In early 07, she was still at the Brookings Institution, and it shocked a lot of people who thought that because she had been in the Clinton administration, she was going to be a natural Hillary Clinton supporter. And, you know, that was not forgotten in what's called Hillary land.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. So, with North Korea launching this rocket, what happens next? Do we have any leeway to put more pressure on China to react to what North Korea is doing?
Well, you know, the first thing you heard before the launch happened was that North Korea would be subjected to Iran-style sanctions, which is to say, you know, cut off all of their other sources of revenue. It was a great soundbite. Except if you've been watching North Korea and its sanctions for the past 20 years, in which case you would know that the Iran sanctions were inspired by a set of sanctions that the United States executed against a bank in Macau that Kim Jong-il, the late leader of North Korea, used as his personal piggy bank to go help support his own power base in North Korea. And boy, did they scream when the U.S. cut off that bank. And as part of the deal, one of the previous deals with North Korea, the U.S. let up on that bank. So, yes, there are many things you can do to North Korea. Will any of them work without China? No. So why would the Chinese sit around and try to think up excuses that would lead them into nasty exchanges with Susan Rice at the UN on Wednesday? There's really only one reason, and you find the answer to this actually in the WikiLeaks cables, which is that the Chinese have an abiding fear that the North Korean government is so fragile that it will one day collapse, that South Korea will take over the North, that the American allies will be right up behind them, and that it will put the U.S. and South Korea right on the Chinese border. And so when you ask the Chinese, if you could pour truth serum into them and say, what's worse, a nuclear and missile-armed North Korea or the Americans on your border, they'd say the Americans on our border.
Indeed.
Yeah, I'm laughing because there's a perfect parallel here. I mean, the reason that the Russians have been so loyal to Assad is because he's been their most important, biggest ally in the Middle East. And remember, Syria is the site of Russia's only military base outside of the former Soviet Union, the Tartus naval base that gives them access to the Mediterranean. Likewise, China has been such a defender on the Security Council of North Korea because they don't want to see the collapse of that nation. They don't want to see hundreds of thousands or millions of refugees streaming across their border. I mean, each of these countries has very strong reasons for doing what they do and defending those nations.
Let's talk quickly about what's happening in Egypt and the constitution referendum that's going to take place. What's at stake here, David?
Well, what's at stake is the continuity of the government of President Mohamed Morsi, the Muslim Brotherhood government, we would say, which has supported this referendum on a constitution that was quickly written. The people who've analyzed it carefully tell me it has a lot of little mistakes. It's just not a document that Egyptians 100 years from now will be proud of. I think the most important thing that's happened in the last couple of days is the decision by the opposition to tell its followers to vote no, but to participate in the referendum.
Rather than
for a long time they were going to boycott. And the reason that that's important is the no's will lose. The Constitution will be endorsed in this vote. But the legitimacy of the government and the process going forward, I think, will remain intact because people voted in the referendum, they lost, and then they'll say, we oppose this constitution, but they're not challenging the sort of fundamentals. And I think that was the toughest decision the opposition had to face. They know their backs are against the wall, in a sense.
David Ignatius of the Washington Post. When we come back, time to open the phones, your comments, questions. I look forward to hearing from you.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com. By the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And by Carnegie Corporation of New York, a foundation created to do what Andrew Carnegie called real and permanent good, celebrating 100 years of philanthropy. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, we remember sitarist Ravi Shankar, who died Tuesday at the age of 92, and listen back to our 1999 interview with him. And we'll feature an interview with Randy Newman. It was just announced that he'll be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame next year. Join us.
And it's time to open the phones, 800-433-8850. First to Casanova, New York. Good morning, Aaron.
Good morning. Good to hear your wonderful voice.
Thank you.
I think that I'd like to offer an idea for the panel to consider. There's a lot of desirable beachfront property in the Southern Oceans that Russia, I'm sure, would enjoy having a greater influence in. And I would predict that in this new century, especially as China and North Korea, its satellite, are flexing their military muscle and economic muscle, that Russia will be coming into NATO, and that as we move into the Syria area, Russia will move into the Iran area.
How do you feel about that? Possibility, David.
Well, Russia's always said to be hungry for warm water ports. That was supposedly the driver of the great game. In the coming century, we may have the melting of ice in the north so that Russia gets ports all along the Arctic Circle, so they won't need to go to Iran.
All right. Thanks for calling. Now to Kalamazoo, Michigan. Hi, Charles.
Oh, hello. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I was actually originally calling to ask about Susan Rice's resignation. I mean, whether that was influenced much by the criticism I've been hearing of her handling of African issues during the Clinton administration and then as a consultant afterwards. And I was also wondering about replacing General Petraeus at the CIA and whether that might have any policy effects on sort of the demilitarization of the CIA in the next couple of years.
All right. Thanks for calling, Indira.
Well, let's keep in mind she didn't resign. She just merely withdrew her name from consideration for Secretary of State, so she has not left the UN post. And I would say that no, the criticism about her has not been about her handling of African issues under the Clinton administration. While the whole Benghazi gate issue certainly brought out critics from all corners, and there were people who criticized her handling of Rwanda, for example, she was by no means the main person in charge of that policy. She was merely a director at the National Security Council, later Assistant Secretary of State. And it was Susan Collins of Maine who brought up the issue of, oh, well, when she was Assistant Secretary of State, don't forget there were bombings in Tanzania and Kenya, and, you know, maybe she didn't give the security that those embassies needed. In fact, again, I think that's an unfair criticism because the Assistant Secretary of State for Africa or any regional assistant secretary is not the person in charge of deciding about security. And she did run the Crisis Operations Center in the aftermath of those attacks.
David.
Well, Indira is absolutely right. There is there's a separate post or many posts in the State Department that's responsible for embassy security. But let's get to the second part of the caller's interesting question, which is about whether or not the appointment at the CIA might end up in reversing the increasing militarization of the agency. We don't know who the appointee is going to be there. If it is the current acting director, Mike Morrell, he comes out of the analytical branch of the CIA. I think David's our CIA expert here, but I think the last analyst to go run the CIA would have been Bob Gates, if I'm right. Mm-hmm. If Morrell, who is known as something of a skeptic about the long-term utility of drones, for example, whether or not the kind of backlash that you get from them is worse than your tactical advantages from them, or at least has raised the question, then you could begin to see a bit of a reverse. But remember, this is not a policy that is within the realm of the CIA director. This is very much from the president's own light footprint strategy of using more drones, more cyber, and more special forces instead of sending waves of soldiers into the Iraqs and Afghanistans of the world.
Dave.
I think David is right about Michael Morrell, who was one of the two leading candidates. And I think there is the beginning of a consensus that the CIA needs to shift its balance away from emphasis on paramilitary covert action, of which drone attacks are an example, but in this counterterrorism fight, there have been so many instances of this, and back towards the traditional CIA mission of stealing secrets, of gathering foreign intelligence. And I think both of the two leading candidates, John Brennan, who is currently the White House counterterrorism chief, and Michael Morrell, believe that that shift in the balance is appropriate, and I would think that would be backed by the White House.
Here's an email from an individual who says, I'm a student at the University of North Texas. We have been following the Syrian conflict. What I learned is that there are supporters of Assad, and they fear for their president. They claim the West tells lies about their country and their president. I'm sure we've heard that before, David.
Well, particularly among Syrian minorities, there is a feeling that Assad has presided over a secular state in which Christians, Alawites, other minorities are full Syrian citizens, and there is an enormous fear that the regime that's coming will be dominated by Sunni extremists, and that the plight of minorities, Christians and Alawites in particular, will be severe. There's real anxiety about that. I hear that from a lot of Syrians, including some Muslims, that they're really there. So that, I think the importance of this new coalition, which is very broad, is it's trying to reassure minorities in Syria, you have a future after Assad.
All right. To Houston, Texas. JP, you're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd like to know if China and Russia has actually sold all their political capital supporting Mr. Assad, and if there's any outlook on if this crisis puts windows on Mr. Obama's doctrine. Thank you.
Have they sold all their political capital? No. The Chinese have invested relatively little in Assad. Remember, Syria is not a significant producer of oil, and that's how you get China's attention in the Middle East. So the Chinese are much more focused on Iran and other oil suppliers. For the Russians, as David and Indira suggested, the big issue here is their base in Syria. But their other issue is that if Assad's going to go, and they clearly smell the same rot in his future that everybody else in the world does, they want to have some influence over whatever government succeeds, as does the United States and as does every other player in the region. And there is the possibility that what you see happen in Syria could be a lot worse than the kind of divisions you've seen break out in Libya and other places post-Assad.
What about what our caller mentioned, Obama's doctrine?
Well, the Obama doctrine I'm familiar with is the one that he enunciated with Libya, in which he said that the United States would be prepared to use military force in situations where our interests are not directly at stake, and that's certainly the case with Syria, only when we were doing so in cooperation with regional powers and with our traditional allies, as in NATO. So that would tell you that if the Saudis, Turks, and our NATO allies said, we think it's important to intervene militarily in Syria, the U.S. would say, okay, we're prepared to be part of that. That's the doctrine I think he's talking about. And clearly, that test hasn't been met yet.
All right. Let me ask you quickly about the European Central Bank. The European Union now has a new bank watchdog. Why was that needed, Indira?
Well, the reason it's important is because it's about basically putting all euro area lenders into a deal that sort of paves a way for the euro firewall fund to provide direct bailouts to banks. This is really important, as Ireland's finance minister was talking about, because when you have sovereign governments bailing out their banks, it's the ability for the sovereign governments themselves to collapse, to not have the ability to support those bank bailouts when you have major, major national banks failing. So the idea of the ECB getting together and having a unified stance on this, having a bank supervisor, really could be a landmark and a major step towards resolving the crisis, which has been going on for 3 years now.
And what do you make of the EU winning the Nobel Peace Prize, David?
You know, I always wonder when the Peace Prize goes to institutions, So in this case, what we've seen happen time and again in recent years with the Nobel Peace Prize is they go to reward what the Peace Prize Committee hopes the future will be. So Barack Obama got one, 9 months into his presidency,
right?
Okay?
Right.
And ended up having to give a speech about when presidents have to go to war, which was not exactly what the Peace Prize group. So the EU gets it just when it's under the most attack, when there's the concern that it could split apart. And this was, I think, the Nobel jury's effort to say, no, this was the right idea. Hold on to it. But it does sort of turn on its head the initial concept of the prize.
All right. Now I want to ask you, David Ignatius, about this new Catherine Bigelow film, because there's been a lot of controversy about it ahead of its release.
Diane, I was able to go to an early showing of it last week and also to talk with the screenwriter, Mark Boal, who worked closely with Catherine Bigelow. It's a fascinating film, but a difficult one. It will be painful for viewers because it places squarely before the audience the question of whether torture, whether what the awful euphemism is, enhanced interrogation techniques, provided some of the leads that led the analysts to the courier known as Abu Ahmed al-Kuwaiti, who then led them to bin Laden's hideout in Abbottabad, Pakistan.
And we should say the film is titled Zero Dark 30.
Zero Dark 30. And the film raises that possibility. After seeing it, I talked with intelligence officials who said basically the following, that we'll never know if it is true that some leads came from these terrible torture sessions. We'll never know if without that information it would have been possible to get in bin Laden and kill him. So my conclusion is that the reason to ban torture is not because we know it doesn't work and we could have killed bin Laden anyway. It's because it's morally wrong. And that in saying it's morally wrong, we won't do it. We have to be open to the possibility that we will lose information that we might want.
But didn't the Senate Intelligence Committee just release?
They did, and I have to say, honestly, I think the account that was given by Leon Panetta in his letter a week after the attack last year when he was CIA director, in which he said you cannot make a definitive judgment about whether without this information, I think that initial reading by the CIA itself is the one that I'm going to lean on.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Are you saying, David, we should see that movie?
Yeah. I mean, it's a really powerful movie. It's very well made. Catherine Bigelow is one of the best directors working in the world today. I'll tell you, your listeners are going to be upset watching parts of that movie as I was.
Are you planning to see it, India?
I'd love to see it.
And you, David?
You know, but my teenage boys are going to be so jealous of Ignatius for having gotten an early look at this.
That's interesting.
But you know, David raises just the right point here, which is, in the end, we've not really had a satisfying debate, even with President Obama's ban on torture, on the question of at what point does a piece of information become so vital that you are willing to step aside from all of the moral strictures that people have laid down, not just during the Obama administration, but even in the second half of the Bush administration. And it's a very uncomfortable debate for American officials to have. It's one that politicians are always carving exceptions on.
Finally, to Lansing, Michigan. Becky, you're on the air.
Thank you. I so appreciate your show. It's so refreshing to have rational discussion. My point that I'd like to make is I'm outraged that Susan Rice had to withdraw at all. I believe that a president should be able to choose his cabinet. But more so, I just wanted to bring up an incident. I'm sure some of your listeners might be familiar. Jon Stewart ran a sadly but clever piece comparing both Rices, Susan Rice and Condoleezza Rice. And it showed, of course, the excerpts of Condoleezza Rice lying about weapons of mass destruction in Iran before she became Secretary of State.
I unfortunately did not see that piece. I'd love to go back and YouTube it now. But I think that, you know, that the point is the larger point is there. And it's one that, you know, certainly Colin Powell made some statements at the United Nations that you could say led to the Iraq War that were certainly not true. I mean, there are many people who have made statements that were not true. The question is, what did they know when they made those statements? And I think we don't have any proof that Susan Rice knew she was saying something that was wrong.
And
finally, I think we'll have to wait and see on that.
Ravi Shankar died Tuesday at age 92. What kind of influence do you feel he had on Western music, David?
Well, I think he kind of, if you could say, mainstreamed Indian music, his beautiful sitar music. It was famously taken up by the Beatles. I think that he ended up being the symbol of the way in which a much broader audience embraced that wonderful music and culture.
Indira.
Yeah, his legacy is incredible. I mean, not only is he really the one who brought sitar music to the West, as David said, because of the Beatles and George Harrison specifically taking him up, but, you know, he popularized Indian classical music for such a broad audience and throughout India as well. I think it's also fascinating he leaves two daughters who are both musicians, Nora Jones and Anushka Shankar Wright. So, you know, it's carrying on in another generation.
Indira Lakshmanan, David Sanger, David Ignatius, and of course, the music of Ravi Shankar. Thank you all. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rainey.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations.